So my guess is that the microphones are working. Welcome, everyone. Bienvenido a tú. Bienvenidos a todos. Apka, swagat, hey. And if I continue, and I only use the 23 different languages that my people speak in Guatemala, we'll spend all night long here calling us welcome in this room. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Hugo Melgar Quiñones. I am the director of the Global Institute for Food Security at McGill University. I am extremely happy to be here. I feel very honored and privileged to welcome you in this session. I arrived in Montreal. Actually, I arrived in Canada about a year ago. It has been a year full of excitement, challenges, a lot of stimuli that brought us to this conference. So welcome to the 6th McGill Conference on Global Food Security. The theme of this year's conference is Strategies Against Food Insecurity and Hunger. And you will have the opportunity today and tomorrow to be part of the unveiling of an era in which we think improve nutrition and food security status of global populations will be driven by agriculture as its sole raison d'être. Je voudrais me présenter. Je suis Hugo Melgar Quiñones, directeur du McGill Institute pour la sécurité alimentaire mondiale. Bienvenue à la 6e conférence McGill sur la sécurité alimentaire mondiale. Le thème cette année est les stratégies contre l'insécurité alimentaire et de la faim. Vous aurez l'occasion de faire partie de l'inauguration d'une ère nouvelle dans laquelle l'amélioration de la nutrition et de la sécurité alimentaire des populations mondiales est entraînée par l'agriculture comme sa seule raison d'être. I hope I didn't destroy this language too much. We are very honored this year to have a distinguished group of participants and speakers coming from very different countries, from Haiti, from Kenya, from Guatemala, from England, from Ethiopia, from Nigeria, from Switzerland, from the United States, and colleagues from other universities in Canada that work in the topic of food security. This year, I would like to acknowledge the presence of some of our colleagues in the audience who will join us tomorrow during our sessions as well. I want to welcome especially Dr. Venkatesh Manar, who is the president of the Micronutrient Initiative, and he will deliver tomorrow morning the keynote address, Improve Food Security and Nutrition Collective Solutions, Limitless Benefits. Looking very much forward to your presentations. I want to thank also the presence of Dr. Kalesos Juma, Professor of the Practice of International Development, Director in Science, Technology, and Globalization Project at the Harvard Kennedy School in Massachusetts. He was recently honored at the June convocation ceremony for our Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. And he will deliver the afternoon keynote address tomorrow under the title Agriculture, Biotechnology, and Food Security, Threat or Opportunity. Besides the distinguished speakers we have and will have participating in this conference, I want to acknowledge the work and the contribution of young professionals who study at McGill University, who are contributing also to the effort of the work we are all doing towards food security, the global scene. And I want to acknowledge the presence of Sovita Sor. Sovita is a part of a group of MBA students. You probably read about the McGill students who just recently were awarded $1 million to develop a social enterprise on food security for undernourished communities in urban slums, proposing the consumption of insects as food in those countries. I was very happy, very pleased and privileged to talk with them before they went to this final event, where they won this award. Sovita, please welcome and congratulations. Sovita is part of a group of five students, and they will be presenting tomorrow as well in our conference. I want to welcome also Jasmine Kaur, who's a graduate student in the Department of Food Science and Agriculture Chemistry. Jasmine participated in the 2013 Youth Agriculture Summit, and she is one of seven committee members who were elected as part of this committee and who received a total of $40,000 to launch their work. Please help me welcome Jasmine Kaur. Thank you very much, Jasmine. I would like also to acknowledge and thank the sponsors and donors who support the Global Food Security Conference. In particular, I would like to thank the Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, and we also welcome today Lori Goodwin from Syngenta Canada. We are very pleased that you are joining us this year. So, you're here to listen to a talk that is not by me, right? And I am very, very happy to introduce Marco Ferroni, the Executive Director of Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture in Switzerland. He will deliver the public lecture tonight. His talk is entitled Government and Other Obstacles to Food Security, A Tale of Leadership and Cooperation. Marco Ferroni is Executive Director of the Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, which has as a mission to modernize agriculture and small-scale farming by the route of sustainable intensification, diversification, and links to markets. Scalable solutions for farmers is the motto in six work thrusts: R&D, market-led extension, seed systems incubation, risk management, policy development, and outreach. Before joining the foundation in 2008, Dr. Ferroni held executive and advisory positions at the Inter-American Development Bank and the World Bank in Washington, D.C. Earlier in his career, he worked as a finance and trade diplomat in his native Switzerland. Dr. Ferroni holds a doctoral degree in agricultural economics from Cornell University. All day long, he has been meeting colleagues and other people in this city and join us for a meeting as well in the McDonald campus. I am very happy you're here. Marco, welcome. And please join me in welcoming Dr. Marco Ferroni.
Muchas gracias, Hugo. And again, congratulations on your still very recent nomination to the still very recently founded McGill Institute for Global Food Security. I remember having participated in some early discussions that helped frame some of the concepts that we were saying the Food Security Institute ought to be able to pursue. And I'm very pleased to see now for the first time, because I've only met you today for the first time, that the Institute is in very good hands. So congratulations on that.
Je voudrais aussi dire, mesdames et messieurs, parce que j'ai déjà vu que c'est à peu près normal de commencer une présentation à l'Université de McGill en français. Que je voudrais vous dire que c'est un grand plaisir pour moi d'être ici ce soir. Ma famille et moi, nous connaissons assez bien la belle province. Nous venons ici pour des raisons de travail et plus encore, plus souvent encore pour des raisons de vacances que nous passons. Nous avons déjà passé maintes vacances inoubliables en toutes ces ans, que ce soit pour faire du ski de fond ou pour nager dans vos formidables lacs en été, etc. Donc je peux vous dire que je suis très content de pouvoir être avec vous ce soir. Ladies and gentlemen, again, it is a privilege to be present as we open the 6th McGill Conference on Global Food Security here in Moyse Hall tonight. The conference, and this is the 5th time that I'm participating in it, has by now become a highly regarded element of the global annual calendar of top-level action and learning-oriented reflections on what is mankind's most pressing problem. Certainly, as we look to the future, I think that how to achieve sustainable food security for all is an overriding existential challenge. And so I'm honored to be part of the process of the conference and what the conference seeks to achieve. And again, I would like to thank Professor Melgar Quiñones and also Dean Madramuto for inviting me to speak tonight. I have a few slides, they're just backdrop as you will see, and I'm going to try to bring them up, maybe. That's okay, it's on the desktop, we loaded it on the desktop earlier today. Yeah, there it is, exactly, right. I want to say that, as Hugo mentioned, I spent the day out on the McDonald's campus where I was privileged to be able to participate in a discussion organized by World Vision Canada, McGill University, specifically Hugo's Institute, and the Sustainable Food Lab. It was a discussion entitled Food Security. It was called a Food Security Roundtable, a Global Food Security Roundtable. But what it was about at a very granular level was really how to link farmers to the new opportunities that global markets, agricultural markets, are offering. And as I heard some of these excellent presentations earlier today, I couldn't help thinking that those speakers ought to be here, because basically what I'm going to have to say is very similar to what we heard earlier today. So those of you who have participated there, I don't know, maybe you want to go out and have a drink. For the others, I will be speaking to you about this very same topic, but I'm going to focus differently from what we have heard or from the way the presentations were crafted earlier today in the following sense. I already said to you that those presentations were very hands-on, very practical, very granular in that sense. What I'm going to try to do tonight under this title, and you will see why the title, I'm not going to explain the title at the outset, I think that by the end when we're done you will be seeing why I'm putting this particular title. So what this presentation is meant to do is provide a strategic framework for the kind of concerns that came to the fore in the discussion at the McDonald's campus earlier today. And let me get right into the matter. It is about sustainable food security for all. And sustainable food security for all is attained when everyone has permanent access to a healthy diet of their choice, produced and traded in ways that respect nature with its biophysical and human possibilities and limitations. The biophysical aspects include land and water use, as all of you know, biodiversity, nitrogen and nutrient balances, and also climate change. The human factor has, at a minimum, to do with the welfare of the farm population and of consumers, the functioning of supply chains from production to retail, and how the transformation of the economy plays out over time. I'm referring here to the process of economic diversification, the migration of farm labor away from primary production, the rise of productivity and income differentials across economic sectors, and how societies deal with the many ramifications of this, including the food security implications in the long term. The human factor, which I find useful to consider in this dynamic context of the economic transformation over time, is as much
part of the natural world and thus of the sustainability equation as the biophysical and the environmental aspects. The state of the environment is linked to that of human contentment. A degree of serenity and satisfaction is needed for humans to be good stewards of the environment. Applied to agriculture and farming, this suggests the need for enabling services, skills, and incentives for farmers such that they can pursue production and livelihoods in environmentally responsible ways. I want to talk about this tonight. And I want to focus, as I do so, specifically on empowering farmers so that sustainable food security for all can be brought within reach. As you can imagine, empowering farmers, specifically small-scale, resource-poor farmers in developing countries and emerging markets where food demand growth is high, can be a complex and challenging task. It is a task that calls for contributions from many, in addition to good management and coordination. This makes it a tale of leadership and cooperation across a wide range of actors. Government and markets in particular play critical roles to create the right conditions and respectively develop and deliver the resources and solutions that farmers need. I propose therefore to start this presentation by clarifying what it is then that these farmers want and need. With reference to current and projected food supply challenges, I will secondly explain why it is imperative to develop and deliver the needed means to them. I will thirdly point to some good news. Expanding markets and breakthrough technologies create historic opportunities for action, even as organizational and managerial challenges abound, as well as governance issues at the more macro level. And it is finally to this latter topic that I will then fourthly turn, and devoting the remainder of my presentation to a discussion of institutional aspects and the role of leadership and governance to enable markets to function, science to come to fruition for the benefit of food security, and agriculture, farmers, and again, food security to thrive. I am aware that food security is about more than agriculture and the supply side of things. We were talking a lot about nutrition, for example, at the McDonald's campus today. Still, I propose to focus on this aspect of supply and production for good reasons that I'm sure will become apparent as I proceed. Agriculture and the way we farm must change, ladies and gentlemen. We need to achieve much, much more with much, much less in the form of physical resources such as water and land. We need to intensify and do so sustainably. That's the paradigm to be followed, by substituting smart alternatives for environmental degradation, the destruction of forests, and high carbon methods of farming. I think we can get there as a global community, and I believe that we will, if we drop conventional approaches, embrace the urgency of the matter as underscored by the most recent IPCC report, get practical, and allow common sense to prevail as opposed to ideology and fear. What do all farmers as growers and therefore as entrepreneurs want and need, irrespective of gender, age, farm size, their location on the planet, or other characteristics? If you ask them, their usual answer is what in my language amounts to three things: technology, services, and access to markets. And if you think about it, this is really what counts. Technology comes in the form of inputs that embody science, techniques, and engineering in the areas that have in the past and will in the future make agriculture advance: genetics and plant breeding, soil fertility solutions, crop protection, irrigation, labor-saving devices, connectivity, and post-harvest technology and skills. Services cover a range of resources, including knowledge services and advice, which is often referred to as agricultural extension, better organization of farmers to increase their political and market clout, organization of farmers
also for the purpose of aggregation of produce into new markets that I will be talking about, is central. Other aspects are central, also under what I call the services category. For example, land rights, and we have a major government failure where land rights don't exist or cannot be trusted. Information on markets and the weather are important, crop disease forecasts, soil analysis, and financial services, in particular crop insurance and credit. The third element in the trilogy is access to markets. Access to markets is about the ability for farmers to buy inputs and sell produce and crops. In good measure, this is conditioned by transport and storage infrastructure, prices, procurement policies, and the contracts by which farmers may be linked to markets. There is good news here, in the sense that smallholder farmers occupy an increasingly important segment of the national and global agricultural value chain, and this is the case for two reasons. One, their contribution to market supply is needed in the face of growing demand. And two, there is increasing interest in sustainable sourcing, and this is the case not just anymore, only in OECD countries. And these sustainable sources may include sourcing from smallholders if quality and traceability requirements can be met. The task and opportunity in this space, both of them are huge. The private sector, initially with the help of government and non-profits, must provide for the processes, contracts, and tools, including, for example, mobile phone-based applications and cloud computing to support information systems that are needed to create shared value by linking smallholders to remunerative markets on a massive scale. I'm not talking about project interventions that reach 100 farmers, 1,000 farmers. I'm talking about the need for massive scaling up. There cannot be rural development, environmental stewardship, and food security at the different relevant levels, micro to macro and so on, without this. At least not, again, on the desired territorial scale. The challenge is formidable because of the large number of small farmers thus to be reached, and the challenge varies between different supply chains and segments or capabilities of farmers. We must act on it nevertheless to meet the growing demand for food. And by the way, smallholders themselves want action here. They want to see progress that will enable them to run their farms as businesses, because none of them has ever wanted to be a subsistence farmer. Subsistence farming is a ticket to poverty. It's not a ticket to prosperity. And so there is pressure on the part of the farming population that we act in this sense. I want to talk a little bit about what I call the food supply squeeze on a global basis, which has a lot to do with natural resource degradation and productivity fatigue in the face of unprecedented food demand growth on a global scale. The world's food security is under threat because the system is squeezed by unprecedented demand growth, as I have just mentioned, a deteriorating natural resource base, which is increasingly unpredictable due to climate change, and a slowdown in global cereal productivity growth, to which I will refer in a minute. What this does, if you just accept these three things for the moment, is it puts pressure on the food system, it forces prices upwards, it makes them volatile, among other reasons because of the export restrictions that some countries sometimes impose. And collectively, all of this, and because of the upward pressure on prices, what this does is, on the consumer side, is it reduces real purchasing power and therefore many people's access to food. If that's not a food security issue, I don't know what is. The average annual rate of growth of cereal yields has declined from 3% on average some decades ago to about 1.3% at present, as FAO data arranged in the form of five-year moving averages, which is the graph that you're seeing, show. We can debate exactly why this is so. It's very important to realize that this does not mean that productive capacity is not there. But this level barely keeps up with population growth, as you can see, look at the red curve. And therefore, this, what I'm calling productivity fatigue, leaves no slack in the system to absorb income growth-induced additions to demand or supply shocks due to adverse weather. In the past, income growth-induced additions to demand were not very important compared with the effects of population growth. With the advent of high rates of economic growth in key populous countries, and this is only really 20 years period that we are talking about, with the advent of high rates of economic growth in key populous countries, including more recently in much of Africa, this has changed, and the forces in question can be expected to remain in place for a very long time. The effects of income growth on the demand for food are mitigated by what economists know as Engel's law, and they are shaped by what economists know as Bennett's law. The tendency, respectively, for the proportion of income spent on food and the starchy staple ratio in the diet to decline as income grows. Bennett's law thus governs the widely observed shift to diversified, more meat-based diets as incomes grow. So food demand growth induced by income growth will stabilize at some point in the future. This is what Engel's law says. Just as population growth is expected by some projections to stabilize by the middle of this century. But all of this is speculative. Depending on the sum of the actual experience in different countries, the point where the average global level of income is sufficiently high for the two laws to kick in fully and for the effects of Engel's law to begin to prevail over Bennett's is, I would think, at least 100 years away. In the meantime, the world must learn to produce the additional food that consumers demand in ways that are compatible with long-term survival and thus the tenets of sustainability. Multitudes, conveying the notion of growing demand. There is an opportunity for action in this picture that I'm presenting. It has to do with growing demand, therefore expanding markets, and also, and I will talk about this, breakthrough technology. Look at, from this angle, actually, the demand growth, and therefore, as I'm saying, expanding markets, coupled with breakthrough technology, can be seen as a huge and historic opportunity to elicit the supply response of which farmers are perfectly capable, including small-scale farmers, as long as they have the right kind of support. And in fact, this is particularly true of small-scale farmers because of their current low yields. The thought is this: the dynamic demand situation I have just described offers opportunity, as I'm saying, for the first time in history on a massive scale to unlock the productive potential of small farmers and in the process produce rural development and enough food if the technologies that are needed for sustainable productivity growth can be generated and disseminated in ways farmers can adopt and if farmers can be linked to the value chains and consumers in mutually advantageous ways. Gone are the days where we were able to look at farmers essentially as loci for productivity improvement. If you want productivity improvement in today's market-based reality, you've got to, at the same time, ensure access to markets. For many reasons. One of them simply is that productivity improvement will require purchased inputs, and you need to generate the wherewithal to pay for that from somewhere. Inside of the farm enterprise, that somewhere is the market on the output side of the story. The technological possibilities are not going to stand in the way of this vision. They are numerous and exciting. Today we can see the contours of breakthroughs and progress across a wide range of applications allowing novel, integrated solutions. Consider, for starters, plant breeding, animal breeding, in the age of genomics, low-cost sequencing, bioinformatics, the platform of omic sciences and translational research to foster the discovery and the identification of candidate genes. Consider the acceleration of breeding programs now possible
and their particular value in uncertain times marked by climate change. Consider, beyond plant breeding, the advances in biotechnology to develop agronomic and yield-enhancing characteristics, as well as developments in biologicals derived from natural sources to buttress plant health and protect against insects and diseases. Furthermore, consider advances in chemistry and seed treatment to convey advanced vigor to plants and again protect them against weeds, diseases, pests, and abiotic stress. Consider digitization, georeferencing, mechanization guided by mobile computing, micro-irrigation, safe, effluent using irrigation techniques and soil fertility solutions that make precision agriculture viable and possible. And finally, consider the advances in communication technology that lead to new value propositions and opportunities to engage farmers, offer agronomic and agriculture extension support, guide production methods to meet quality standards and certification requirements, and conduct numerous business transactions in agriculture that can involve small-scale farmers. The new possibilities for synergies and integrated solutions seem endless. All of the new technologies, like the older ones too, have the advantage of being divisible, which means that they can be applied irrespective of farm size and are therefore relevant for small farmers. If my vision of farmer empowerment fails, it will not have been for lack of technology. It will have been because of unsolved challenges related to institutional aspects, governance, delivery and implementation, and it is to this, the institutional and implementation aspects and challenges that could interfere with the task, it is to this that I now turn. Farmer empowerment on the scale envisaged requires many contributions from innovative ideas to social entrepreneurship and from proof of concept, for example, regarding methods of aggregation, all the way to points where scaling up through market mechanisms can take hold. I am aware of many efforts along these lines in Africa, South and East Asia and Latin America. They organize and mentor farmers. They intermediate financing, inputs, and technical assistance, help create supply chains, and link farmers to buyers, as in the case of this example where our foundation works with an agribusiness firm, GATCO is its name, and local government in Ghana to craft outgrower schemes for rice, whereby small-scale farmers can be linked to a dynamic operation spearheaded by a large farm to which a rice processing facility is linked. Many of these efforts that I'm talking about here design market-enabling solutions that reduce risk and uncertainty, create new standards, and lower transaction costs. That's what it's all about. Advanced market commitments made to seed companies so they can extend their offer to what may initially be uncertain markets among smallholder farmers are an example of controlling risk. Another one is agricultural index insurance, the suite of products in this space that our foundation and our partners have been able to develop in recent years and are currently disseminating in East Africa. All of these efforts have one thing in common. Partnership. Partnership is the means to combine the complementary strengths of public, private, and voluntary actors to achieve desired smallholder-relevant benefits that none of them could produce on their own. Partnership is of the essence in the unstable space of smallholder empowerment, and it is needed in two areas related to agriculture. One, R&D and the delivery of research goods to farmers, and two, bringing markets, agricultural markets, to life. Partnership is the method by which to overcome the manifestations of government failure that so often appear to underpin the failure, or more precisely, the non-functioning of markets. Markets, in my observation, time and again, prove that they function by not operating in the face of government failure. I am not using the terms market failure and government failure lightly here. I am aware that the very concepts can be controversial in both theory and practice, and that the debate is often inconclusive. I support enlightened government action to supply public goods, avert undesirable externalities, and guide distributional outcomes. But I also know that special interest politics, information asymmetries, and poor governmental implementation and enforcement capacity can foil the best of intentions. Without going into the literature and the theory of all of this, I think partnerships offer practical opportunities to address constraints that seem to derive from institutional or government failure. To see this, let us look at public agricultural research on the one hand, and seed systems, in this case in particular in sub-Saharan Africa, on the other. The world needs public, national and international agricultural R&D, just as it needs all of the crop improvement research carried out in universities and the private sector. But ladies and gentlemen, public research is not or no longer delivering. Perhaps with such exceptions as China and Brazil. We've done a lot of work on this. I know what I'm talking about. I'm happy to engage this in the discussion. Adoption rates by smallholders are too low and too slow to meet the productivity and sustainability challenges they face. Just look at the yield gaps. The research goods available to farmers may not meet their needs, in part because the public sector may have prioritized work according to science or public policy-derived criteria as different from demand-led criteria. Public institutions do not have a good record of progressing R&D from the R stage to that of D, i.e., the development and delivery of products into seed and other distribution channels. Partnerships with the private sector, which brings a different business orientation to the table, as well as valuable advanced research skills, might help. Examples of this, positive ones, exist. But even they will not help if variety testing and release and registration regulations are not improved. The goal of public breeding programs is ultimately to see improved germplasm become widely available to smallholder farmers as seed or planting material of improved varieties. While informal seed systems absolutely, as well as public providers, absolutely have a role to play, delivering technology on a massive scale requires commercial solutions. These are unlikely to come about by themselves in strongly governance-challenged territories. They need to be nurtured into existence by measures in the public interest that mitigate risk and may include funding and other catalytic support. Partnerships between the seed industry, public regulatory entities, non-profits such as NGOs or foundations, and funding agencies can kickstart commercial seed multiplication. Examples again exist. India developed its seed industry this way over a 50-year period. EPIC PPP, public-private partnership between government, in this case, the research entities and the regulatory entities and the nascent initially and then very well-developed seed industry. This is how it came about. The seed industry in India would not have come about without nurturing along from by the public sector, which in this case essentially took hold along two lines. First of all, conducive regulatory contributions by the government, obviously, and secondly, the sharing of germplasm between national and international agricultural research establishment on the one hand and the seed industry, initially for free and later on against payment of royalties, as it should be. This is the sort of solution that Africa needs. And our foundation, I'm happy to be able to report, is working on this together with partners. We're making this happen in Africa, again, together with partners, along with, it says here, along with others, but I already said this. Government failure in the form of inefficient seed laws in many countries is among the aspects that those trusts are addressing. Now, designing and implementing the right public policies, investments, and regulations to promote food security is not a trivial task. The scope for errors of omission and commission is in complicated political economies and policy spaces is huge. This is why I was surprised the other day to see the results of a public opinion survey on agriculture and food in which people from 13 countries across the globe ranked government first as the entity they trust to fix food security. Farmers were seen as somewhat important only in the US, France, Russia, Kenya, and India out of this sample of 13 countries. They're hardly in the public consciousness of increasingly urbanized societies. The role of the business sector was similarly seen as negligible in this survey, with a bit of an exception in Switzerland and Germany, just two countries, and these two at the same time are also the countries together with France that, according to the survey, seem to be attaching some importance to NGOs as putative bearers of answers to food security. My own view is different from what you see projected here. We live in a world of market-based approaches to economic development and growth. Farmers, large and small, obviously, and as markets develop, the business sector that supports them play fundamental roles in agriculture. How could people forget? NGOs and civil society similarly play fundamental roles. Governments play or should play fundamental roles in at least five areas: infrastructure, human capital development, R&D, the rule of law, and the cultivation of expectations and measures to foster accountability and eradicate the burden of corruption. The state of achievement in these government fundamentals is often parlous in agriculture-based states, with adverse effects on farming, sustainability, and the scope for agribusiness development compared with what could be. Policy consistency is in this context another aspect that I want to mention before I close. New research by colleagues from, in particular, Michigan State University and the FAO, research in West Africa, documents how policy inconsistency and reversals make the private sector reluctant to invest in agriculture and food value chains. Government then views this reluctance as a market failure, emits yet further policy changes, and generates a vicious cycle of instability. That's documented in this study, which I'm recommending to you. I can give you the reference later on. And in this study, soon to be published by the FAO, the researchers argue that policy constancy in government fundamentals, the ones that I've mentioned above, is needed to break these public-private deadlocks and create the conditions for public-private partnerships to arise. How can I put all of this in perspective and conclude? The scope for improved governmental action to benefit agriculture and the development of supply chains is clearly considerable. The farmers are not the problem, never. Come visit projects with me in the field. They are eager to work and improve their situation. The demand for their products is there. Science and technology are evolving towards sweet spots where innovations that were previously unheard of become feasible. The problems lie elsewhere. They lie in the delivery. We need to deliver these innovations, relevant services, and access to markets to the farm population as we build agri-food value chains. We need to combine the motivations and skills of different stakeholders and work together, incubating solutions and approaches and scaling up. I view this as the answer to food supply, sustainability, and rural development challenges in a long view of economic development, where agriculture is eventually modernized, more consolidated, and highly productive, and where the bulk of employment shifts from primary production to other pursuits that create enough value to ensure food security for all. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. And thank you all. Before we move into questions, comments by the audience, to Dr. Ferrani. I want to thank also a couple of all the people who are joining us in this conference, if you allow. Mrs. Erin Hogg, who kindly is sponsoring an award for our graduate students in the conference tomorrow, is with us as well. I want to welcome also Mr. Michel Chancy, who is the Secretary of State for Animal Production from Haiti. And I'm very pleased that he's here to share with us his experiences from his country and perhaps some thoughts about how it is growing in Montreal, growing up in Montreal, and then working in Haiti in this very important role he has in his country. I want to greet also a Professor Kusha, who Emmanuel Kusha, who is the Vice Chancellor of the University of Agriculture in Makurdi in Nigeria. Welcome to this conference as well. So, I know that people are anxious to present their questions and their comments to you, Marco, and I just want to make sure that the microphones are available in the room. If someone can signal to me that the microphones are here, and if not, then perhaps you need to shout your question. No. Give me just 1 minute. I'm just hoping that someone will come from the support in this room, support staff. Sorry, my eyes. All right. So in that case, I think, Marco, I will ask if that's okay with you to come back to the stage, because here we have a microphone for you to respond, and hopefully we'll be able to listen to your questions from
thank
here.
You. Thank so, you so much. Please. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Again, it's great to see you again and to be able to continue this conversation. I just want to make a parenthetical remark about one aspect you mentioned at the beginning of your intervention, namely GMOs. And let me say that GMOs are basically, at some level, a little bit of a sideshow in this whole thing, because we got much more important pursuits to deliver on, specifically what I've tried to explain, how to bring farmers to markets and so on. But then again, GMOs are very important. I shudder to think what food prices would have been in during the period of food price escalation 07, 08, 09, and so on, when we had food riots and so on, without the addition to supply in basic grains and such things as soybeans, and therefore soybean oil produced by large-scale farmers that essentially from, for example, Brazil, the United States, Canada, and Argentina, that use GM traits. I can tell you that food prices would have been a lot higher, and food and hunger would have been a lot higher as a result. So therefore, GM, while we should not get excessively distracted, because we've got big issues to address that can be addressed without looking at GM, they do have an important role in terms of assuring supply in the stressed global food system. Now, your point about scaling up really has, to me, everything to do with bringing commercial solutions into what currently could be characterized as pre-commercial agricultural settings. I do not think, and I've mentioned this in my talk, that we can scale up through projects. I think that we use projects and need projects to learn, to develop proof of concept, to create initial conditions that can lead to the development of markets. But I think that the territorial impact that we need if you're interested in food security in the rural areas and rural development and therefore rural income increase has to come about through markets, and that's my recipe for scaling up.
Suppliers of the market. I believe pretty much in the organization of cooperatives as being a way of going around. In Latin America, it's very obvious. Maybe less obvious in Africa. It's a little bit tougher in Africa, the model of cooperatives. But we still have to work on these farmer aggregation as cooperatives that could be a complete solution.
Thank you. I don't think that empowerment can be dictated from outside. You cannot be empowered if you get empowered by ways in ways that you don't think are the right ways in which you want to shape your life and the life of your community. So farmers have to be consulted, they have to be part of the process that we are talking about, but they have to be organized and they have to be strengthened in their own capacities at the community level, for example, to organize themselves. Farmer organization is central to the notion of empowerment because it is not possible for markets to deal with individual smallholders, thousands and thousands, in fact hundreds of millions of them, where each of them is only able to generate a very small marketable surplus, for example, or purchase very small quantities of inputs. That is where organization comes in, and the right kind of organization, producer organizations, whether it's cooperatives of new kinds. Cooperatives also have not a very good name in the past, as you know. I don't want to pronounce myself on this, but organization is an essential element of the empowerment that I'm talking about. Please, bonsoir.
Question of food sovereignty. It's a question that has been recurrent in my experience so far, particularly in Haiti. And I would like to hear your take on how food sovereignty can be linked up to market development. Thank you.
Food sovereignty gets a lot of good press in some quarters, but I have a relatively dim view of it. When countries such as Russia last year, in following its major drought in the summer of 2012, I believe, imposed export restrictions. That was an act of food sovereignty. When Mali, which is a grain typically, traditionally speaking, with a long-term view at the grain supply situation in that country relative to neighboring countries in West Africa, imposes export restrictions because food prices go up, that's an act of food sovereignty. I don't think it is a good policy. I think that what export restrictions do as an act of food sovereignty is they penalize your domestic farmers in your own country, as well as they penalize the consumers in importing countries. So I would like to argue for a trade-based approach to food security as a matter of principle. Now, against that, I know that it warms my soul, and presumably everyone else is in this room, if I can say I'm consuming locally grown food. And we should go for locally grown food where this makes sense, but not at the expense of trade.
We have programs working with partners, for example in Kenya, where farmers are mentored to produce high-quality, safe, global GAP-compliant vegetables of various kinds for the European market. When the European Union in January of this year tightened its quality standards on imports from Kenya, that was a sort of food sovereignty act also, which I'm not faulting because I understand that the regulator in that part of the world wants to be true to the interests of their consumer. But I can tell you that it created major income loss, setbacks into poverty and other problems among the 100,000 farmers that these programs that we are associated with in Kenya entail. So when it comes to food sovereignty, I would like to inject a note of caution.
I'm a PhD student in Wageningen University in the Netherlands, and I graduated in Zurich.
Congratulations, do you have a job?
I'm one comment and a question. First, my comment. You talked about technology for food security in Africa. You talked briefly about technology and other technology, but I just want to say that. We're working a lot in Zambia on indigenous knowledge for farmers, and we think that indigenous knowledge is also part of the solution. And my question is, you mentioned that policy inconsistency is one of the major problems in African government being important for security. But my question is, how to partner, how to make that partnership between government in Africa and other stakeholders, other private stakeholders, knowing that government policies are much driven by external funders who directly dictate their view on how they should go about their policy.
Could you say your question this way so we can hear it also?
Yeah, thank you. My question is about policy in Africa. What I'm seeing is that policy in Africa is, for a large extent, driven by external countries, American countries or European countries. And in the talk, I heard about inconsistency in policy in Africa. And what I'm asking is how to realize that partnership between African government and stakeholders in Africa to go about that or that issue.
Big question, if I knew the answer. You see, aid, I think, needs to evolve towards accepting the fact that there is massive change occurring in the world out there, in part because of the successes of aid in the past. What we are seeing, in part supported by aid in the past, is market-driven approaches to economic development and growth. In this situation, the role of the government changes, and I would submit that potentially the role of the donor agencies also should change towards a stance that is geared toward enabling markets to function. Now, I want to give you an example that comes from R&D, and the gentleman in the past actually asked a question about some of the partnerships that we are engaged with. I think that I did not answer, and I'll get to that too. There is not enough agricultural research investment for the crops that African farmers grow. Public investment, despite the presence of aid in agricultural R&D, has been declining, and the capability of the institutions is not up to that which is needed, even though I'm aware that there have been very important advances
in the last 15 or so years, owing in particular to the, in terms of capacity of national agricultural research institutes, owing in particular to the fact that a new generation of highly trained people such as yourself is coming on stream. That is a laudable event. Still, the institutional capacities are limited in relation to the needs that derive from the huge yield gaps that we are seeing. And so my question is, something that I'm asking myself is, how can we increase the capacity and funding in agricultural research? Why don't the donors put more funds into it? Now, funding for ag research is nowadays something that's no longer in the public domain alone. It has shifted more and more into the private domain, but only for crops that are of interest to the commercial, that are of commercial interest. Funding for crops where you can have value of research by the private sector, for crops where you can have value capture because they are hybrids or GM traits, is there. It's up to the level that the companies can afford, and it is up to the level where the opportunities, that the opportunities dictate. Why can't we come up with a system of value capture for agricultural research in OPV crops, open pollinated ones, the ones typically that are needed in the bulk of African agriculture? And here, Australia has recently, in the last 10 years, essentially come up with something that is very interesting, and that is called their endpoint royalty model. And they're applying it to wheat, and I happen to know that the Canadian wheat industry is looking at this as a potential way to fund their, in their view, and I think they're right, underfunded wheat research capacity. So the endpoint royalty model is one where the grower pays a royalty on every ton or every kilo of seed that they buy. In the Australian wheat system, I seem to remember that those royalties range between $1 and $4 per ton of seed. This is a way whereby the private sector can now get into wheat or other OPV breeding. And as a result, and this is on the record for Australia, we are seeing an acceleration of breeding products coming onto the market and an acceleration of improved breeding products being planted in farmers' fields. Now you're going to tell me that the African farmer cannot afford such a royalty. Well, why don't we engineer donor subsidies in order to make this possible during an initial period of 5 or 10 years or more years, as long as may be reasonable? Aid must be focused, and in some instances it does, but in others I know that it does not, on such very practical value-generating approaches. I think that would be my answer to your question. You raised another different point in your, at the beginning of your intervention when you were talking about indigenous knowledge of farmers. That, I think, did not lead to an actual question, but let me ask a question that you may have wanted to answer, a question that you may have wanted to ask, which is about the role of indigenous knowledge versus knowledge that comes from the outside, right, to farmers' fields. My view on this is the following. Indigenous knowledge is central. The farmer knows many things best because they and their family may have been there for generations and they know their ecology, their land, the quality of their soils, and so on. That has to be factored into production decisions and into breeding decisions and into input supply decisions so that the inputs that are coming in are compatible with that local knowledge. However, at the same time, there is a need for externally supplied science and technology-driven knowledge that the farmer, by definition, does not have access to. That needs to come out from the outside in the form of various forms of agricultural extension, whether publicly supplied or privately supplied or supplied by NGOs or agents of empowerment in the context of farmer organizations. I don't really care as long as it's delivered. In other words, as long as we're talking about it, about knowledge that is being conveyed to the farmer that really makes a difference in terms of their needs. So I view indigenous knowledge and knowledge that necessarily must come from the outside if we're interested in productivity improvements, which we must be interested in if we're interested in sustainability issues, there must be a positive, good interaction and confluence between those two sources of knowledge.
Thank you very much for a very inspiring talk. My name is Dolph Tomisco. I'm a fellow in the Institute of Development Studies in the UK. I wanted to make a couple of observations and have a question as well for you. First observation sort of relates back to your response just now, the discussion around sort of how come sort of fields and productivity are declining and the role of sort of public R&D in this. I would like sort of to point out sort of to people in the room who perhaps are not familiar with some of the historical sort of background here, that of course that during the 1980s and 1990s sort of, there has been sort of a systematic sort of attack by the world sort of funding institutions, by the World Bank, etc., on the capacity of particularly African governments to conduct this kind of research. So perhaps it's useful to have that in mind. There is no capacity or yields are possible or new research is not coming through because of that background. I think it's sort of just a quick point. More generally, I think sort of your talk sort of raised some really sort of good issues around the importance of better governance in terms of delivering sort of better services to farmers, the role of smoother functioning of markets to clearly has an important role in this. But I think it's also useful to point out that perhaps even though at the beginning of your talk you say, well, let's talk about food security, is all about sort of everybody having access. It seems to me that the definition that you're using is not the most commonly accepted one, which is that one by the Food Agriculture Organization of the UN, which emphasizes four points which are integral to food security. Availability of food, so physical availability, access of all people, stability of markets, and the way in which you utilize the four needs of food. Now, even though you stress to the point of access, most of the discussion actually is geared around availability. You emphasize the importance of generating and the need, and the clear need to generate more food. But we, of course, very well know that sort of generating food in its own right is completely insufficient to ensure individuals food security. Because food security isn't just about having enough food, it is about individuals' access to this food. So it's about people's income, so it's about poverty, it's also about social entitlement of people. So to me, it sort of seems that even though you're saying a lot of sort of sensible things, the upshot of it is, or perhaps my question observation is, are you perhaps a little bit over-optimistic? Were you bristling in terms of the potential that sort of technological fixes and sort of better governance can actually have for delivering enhanced food security for individuals?
Yeah, good set of questions. First of all, on what is known as the structural adjustment period, right, in particularly which was very virulent and of course also controversial in Africa, there is a good thing that came from it for agriculture and a less good thing. The good thing has to do with the macro level adjustments that which economists know as the real exchange rate, the fiscal adjustments, the reduction in inflation and so on, the expenditure switching. That was really good for agriculture because that sort of category of policies is good for the tradable sector in your economy, and agriculture is the quintessential tradable sector unless you're an oil exporting country. What was less good in hindsight is that more should have been done to preserve institutions and to further strengthen them. On your aspects of the definition of food security and the four aspects that the classical FAO, World Bank, etc. definition stipulates, I completely agree. And I've said as part of my remarks that there is more to food security than supply. But I've also tried to explain that from the supply perspective, from therefore the principle of availability perspective in the complex in the multidimensional definition of food security, there is something new happening, which is happening since about 2005. I didn't mention that date, and that is that we got supply stresses in the system, and that's why I'm talking about supply. And also, we got to talk about supply if your topic is farmers. My topic is, in this case, the rural world and farmers and so on. There's plenty of poverty in the rural areas and so on that requires presumably if we want development, Millennium Development Meeting of Millennium Goals and so on, we've got to do something about that, and that has got to have something to do with productivity enhancement measures and links to markets by definition. Now, of course, we can look at the farm population out there, 500 million small-scale farmers operating at up to 2 hectares in non-OECD countries in the world today, and the number of those small-scale farmers is increasing, for example, because in India of partible inheritance and other structural situations. Now, of those 500 million, 40%, 30%, maybe not 40%, easily 30% are perfectly food secure and commercial. They're actually not on my radar screen. I'm now talking about a sort of a segmentation of the farmer, the small farmer population, right? Another 10 or 15% we cannot act on or work with, rather, with the tools that I have set out in my talk because they're too poor. Many of them in Asian settings would be landless laborers. You cannot support their situation by agricultural intensification except indirectly through the demand for labor that may increase as yields increase. But then there is this other segment of 40% of those smallholder farmers, or I don't know exactly, nobody knows exactly how many because, look at the data on this. We've done analytical work up and down with respect to smallholder segmentation in my foundation, which are a group of, in which hundreds of millions of farm families fit, which are what I call pre-commercial. And I'm using that term to convey the notion that through the right kind of mentoring and support and links to ag extension and other tools that I've tried to describe, you can raise them to a commercial sort of situation. And that is what will lead to income improvements and therefore, by definition, some level of food security improvements. Now, of course, I know that nutrition is not linked directly to production and to income. We know that, very complex. And it was discussed a bit this afternoon out on the campus. And I have not gone into nutrition, therefore the food use principle of availability in my talk tonight. But availability is a dimension that has become much more important in recent times, and given the stresses in the system that I have tried to explain because of the income effects on which have an effect on making demand go up for a long time to come, what this all means is that availability is becoming a very important and for a long time lasting aspect of food security that we have to deal with. In the end, it is always about, my food security is always a question of access at the individual level, the household level. At some level, at the national level, it's always a function of income, food security, not nutrition. But if there are stresses on the supply side that lead to price increases, then that will reduce your purchasing power as a consumer and therefore your access to food. In situations, not perhaps at our level of income, but if you are at a level of income where you're spending 70% of your income on food, then a small marginal increase in the price of your basic staple will introduce hunger or malnutrition because now you're spending your money on rice, i.e. the staple, but you cannot afford the nutritious components anymore in the vegetable and meat and whatever categories of diet. It's going to be much more complicated, much more challenging feeding the world going forward than it may have been and it may have seemed in the past, in particularly the more recent past of the 30 years of cheap and abundant food that started in 1975 when the first most recent major food price crisis of 73-74 came to fruition, played out. You had low prices from 75 to 2005. Since then, we're in a qualitatively different world. And if the income and population and productivity stagnation or fatigue phenomena, together with the fact that natural resource degradation is really beginning to kick in for the first time in human history, if all of this is true, we're going to see supply issues going forward. And that's an issue that many people don't know. People talk about biofuels, they talk about all sorts of short-term effects that may be and are underpinning the greater volatility in food prices that we're seeing. But the real structural reason or factor that causes upward pressure on food price is in this graph that I showed about productivity fatigue. Okay, final question, right here.
I'd like to ask you two questions about things that were in one of your initial slides. First one is about property rights or tenure security, and the second one is about contracts. And I would position my question around a conference in 1995. A conference was held in Brussels. 1,000 organizations attended and reviewed progress in addressing food security over the previous 20 years. And they concluded that it really may not make a lot more sense to invest in all the factors of production unless we ensure that smallholders have security of tenure, because that was the asset upon which their future livelihood and stability would depend. But given the nature of land rights or the lack thereof, this was seen and has become a major initiative. At this point in time, many people, including several that I've spoken to today, are well aware that one of the greatest challenges to the security of smallholder farmers is the amount of land grabbing that is going on. The number of small holders, even if we provided them with access to the various inputs that you have described, may not any longer have the rights to the very land to make use of those technologies. And while I did not expect you to address all of these issues, I think it would be unfortunate if we went away from this meeting recognizing the benefits and the need for more intensive production, as you pointed out so clearly, without realizing that if we're interested in smallholder farmers, we have to look at the security of their tenure over land and the global rush for land by agribusiness and other investors, including those who are displacing people from their land to produce biofuels as a result of American and European diversion of food subsidies to produce ethanol, so we're producing corn for cars instead of corn for people as a result. And the second question relates to the issue of contracts. The International Union of Food Producers, which represents some of those 500 million people based in Geneva, indicates that there are many aspects of contracts that are needed. The issue is the terms and conditions of these contracts. Contract farming has become very attractive to investors in that they are able to alleviate themselves of the risk because they transfer that to the farmers, yet they require meeting certification standards that are sometimes beyond their reach if they don't have access to the technology. So I don't know whether, and I don't necessarily expect it with my understanding of the contribution that your foundation and your company is making and its particular background more in the seed industry, and that's not a judgment, it's just to say we can't expect you to come here and speak about all factors, but you have a lot of influence in the places in which you're operating. So my question is, how can we, those of us concerned with the issues of tenure security or property rights and of the conditions of contracts, what lessons have you learned in your company that in your foundation that can help us to further advocate for making sure these basic components upon which people's stability will depend are put into place? I imagine you do have experience in these areas and lessons from which we can learn.
Thank you very much. I agree with everything you said. I think that you cannot invest as a farmer if your tenurial security is not guaranteed, right? I do not think, however, like you're saying, that tenurial security should be the only thing that we work on, that we drop everything. You seem to imply that earlier in your intervention, that we drop everything and simply focus on that. I think that we need to move on various fronts together. But yes, and I said that where tenurial security is not given, you've got a major government failure, and so we got to, and the countries need to do something about this, and the international community can be a source of pressure on governments, on public opinion, and so on. It has happened with other campaign issues, and I think that this issue, for some reason, and there maybe you can tell me what you know we can do to, for some reason this doesn't seem to really have risen
to public consciousness or pundit consciousness, communicators and opinion leaders consciousness, that the issue of tenurial rights. What has risen is, of course, what you're calling land grabbing. I'm calling it foreign direct investment. I think that there are positive aspects there, but of course, abusive land grabbing, which leads to losses for the local population, eviction and so on, is wrong. There is a internationally accepted and negotiated, or I don't know if it's negotiated, but it's a code of behavior on land leasing and purchase emitted by the FAO. IFPRI had in the early days when this discussion started a very important role and put a very good set of ethical standards that apply to this question on their website and so on. I would adhere to those. I support those. On contracts and their terms of condition, there's a lot going on in terms of contract farming and so on, good and bad, abusive and non-abusive and so on, and I recognize that. But I think that if you think about it, and here is our experience, maybe I can add that to your perspective, from working in the field, from working with local governments, with NGOs, with farmer organizations all across Africa and Southeast, South Asia and East Asia and so on, that experience tells me the following. Without contracts of some sort, you cannot link farmers to markets on a massive scale. It's inherent in the problem because, like we mentioned it before, you got too many. The numbers are too large. And the quantities that individual producers are able to throw onto the market, marketable surplus, is too small for this thing to be able to be organizable in a way where traders go or buyers go and buy individually from farmer after farmer. You've got to come up with a system, with tight value chains, and they have the nature of contracts one way or another, whether written down or not written down. In the end, perhaps the word contracts may not be the right word. Some colleagues of mine have begun to use the term tight value chains. Of course, we need to define exactly what that means, but there we go. That's the recipe that I have. Now, mobile technology is creating opportunities that we haven't had in the past to develop what in my talk I termed it outgrower schemes. We're actually next year will be throwing on the market an innovative tool that allows farmers to be mentored, coached in the context of contract arrangements with buyers, so that their production the quality of their production, if they follow the protocols, mobile phone based, will then be compliant with the standards that this particular market requires. And I do not believe that farmers cannot be coached and trained, worked with, to be able to produce up to the level of those standards. There are plenty of examples, and some of them we are ourselves as a foundation associated with, that show that this is possible if you make the investment. Some of that investment may need to come from non-profit sources initially paid for by grant funds. That's perfectly fine, because of the developmental aspect of what we're talking about. But it is in the end about predictable supply chains. And the good news, and this is a very important message, ladies and gentlemen, as we probably are closing this session, that I would like for you to take along from this evening as a takeaway, is that demand growth is such that for the first time in the history of the planet, it is possible, if we get our act together organizationally, managerially, and so on, to link farmers to markets on a large scale. Look at the peri-urban vegetable growers around the cities in Africa. Look at them in India. There are statistics that show that the demand for vegetables and fruit and nuts and other high-value products is exceeding supply. We can see that it is exceeding supply. Vegetable markets are sold out by 9 o'clock in the morning. This is a huge opportunity for rural development there, for generating income, with which farmers can then improve their situation, pay school fees and so on, so that the next generation can move off the farm. I have coined the term peasant romanticism about 2 or 3 years ago in this conference, where I said, people, friends, let's not succumb to peasant romanticism. Farming is a business, either if we want to or not. it doesn't matter what we want. It matters what the farmers want. And please come and visit. Let's go. Let's go to India. I'm going in the middle of November. You're welcome to come with me. They want to improve their situation in an economic sense, and that requires access to markets and contracts, or at least predictable, tight supply chains. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry we ran out of time. I think this shows how stimulating presentation by Dr. Ferroni was, and I'm really looking forward to our conference tomorrow for a full day of stimulating presentations, discussions, questions, etc. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We hope that you will join us tomorrow. And again, thanks so much. Welcome again to this sixth conference, McGill Conference on Global Food Security. Have a good evening.